Well, welcome to Who's Talking. Our guest today is Dr. Frank Newport, who's a longtime editor-in-chief at the Gallup Organization. His book is God is Alive and Well, with the subtitle The Future of Religion in America. And Frank Newport, thanks. Welcome to Chapel Hill.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, you're visiting a lot about a topic which interests us. You say in your book that the that those of us who live down in the southern part of the country that we're more likely maybe than folks in other parts of the country to be religious or to have a high degree of religious feelings. How do you know this?
Well, we measure religion through surveys, for one thing, because the Census Bureau doesn't measure religion. Can't, because of the constitutional reasons, so we do it. We ask survey questions. The way we measure religion most often is put together two questions. Is religion important to you in your daily life? And then how often you attend religious services? We put those together in an index, and then we can say, aha, here's the percent in any geographic area that's very religious. And then when we put together 700,000 interviews, we can look at it by state, which we've done, and lo and behold, we find huge differences by state. As you say, the most religious states are in the South. Mississippi is the single most religious state in the country. The other top five are Alabama, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Tennessee. North Carolina is in the top 10. Utah is as well. That's the only state actually out of the South. The least religious states are up in the corners, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, Massachusetts, and then Oregon, Alaska, and Washington in the other corner up there in the north corner. So religion, and these are not minor differences. These are huge differences in religion across these states of the country.
So the people who live in North Carolina or Mississippi or one of the other southern states or Utah are more likely to have answered the question yes on those two questions that you gave us.
That's right. That's our operationalization of religion. Those two questions. But other surveys, I think, show the same thing. It doesn't really matter how you ask about it. There's very little question that if you go to Vermont, you're just on Sunday not going to see a lot of people going to church. And if you're in Mississippi, you're going to see a lot of people going to church.
Well, in your book, you describe your predecessor, the original Dr. Gallup, had a different way to ask this question. And he just kind of came out and said, do you believe in God? And why did you, did you change that? Why did you change his...
Well, we still ask that question.
Oh, you do?
So there are many ways to measure religion. And yeah, he did ask that question, but we still ask that. We just think for basic measure of religion, these other two questions are probably better ways to get at it than the belief in God. Belief in God, by the way, is still above 90% in America today, just as it was when he asked the question many decades ago.
Is the this is an interesting part of the book is that you conclude that America, well, you conclude, as you say in your title, God is alive and well. Part of it is because there's still a strong belief. Part of it is because there's a continues to be a strong belief, 90% or so people who believe in God. But it was a lot more, wasn't it, when Dr. Gallup was asking the question?
Well, not on the belief in God. That's, you know, slightly large, but one of the things I point out is the belief in God has stayed fairly constant. One thing that has changed is religious identification. When he was asking people in the 50s, are you Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, some other religion, no religion, almost everybody said they were something. You know, I'm Baptist, I'm Catholic. Even if they didn't go to church, they said they were something. And now we have up to 18%. Who will say, you know, I'm none of the above. I really don't have a religious identity. So that has changed over the decades, although my conclusion is that doesn't necessarily mean people are less religious now in the totality, but simply that they're religious in different ways and may not have a formal religious identity, but may still be religious underneath it all.
Well, Dr. Newport, when I was growing up, and I'm pretty old, but when I was growing up in the South, of course, I think it might have been true in other parts of the country as well, but we always had a prayer in the school. We even had devotionals that were pretty pretty right down the line in terms of the typical Protestant beliefs of our region of the country. And the other thing, all of the stores closed on Sunday. You know, we were really Sabbath observers to a high degree back then. All that's gone now. And a lot of people say our country's been captured by the secular humanists or by somebody, you know, other things. But so are we still? We can't. I mean, we're not the same nation. We're not still a Christian nation, are we? Or I mean, or if we are, how are we different from 50, 60, 70 years ago?
Well, a lot of things have changed. That's one of the points in the book I keep making, is things always change over time. And you're right, this connection between official laws and policies and religion have certainly changed. When I grew up in Texas, there were blue laws where you certainly couldn't shop for anything but necessities on Sunday, and most stores and malls were closed. And now, of course, there's none of that. But other things have changed. You know, where you could buy alcohol has changed. A lot of things have changed over time. But underneath it all, it's not so clear to me that the religiosity has changed that much as well. And we are still a Christian nation, although a increasing percent say they're nothing. If you just look at people, 82% of Americans who have a religious identity, well over 90% of those, close to 95%, are Christian in one form or the other. So we have a fairly small group of people who are religious, but say they're Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, Zoroastrian, something like that. Most people in the country still are Christian who have a religion, even though things change. Nothing stays the same. Everything keeps changing, just like the way we get our news has changed. It used to be newspapers and Walter Cronkite, and now we get our news on the Internet and a variety through Twitter and all that. So everything keeps changing. That's a constant. Change is constant. But underneath it all, I still think we have a quite religious country.
Well, we talked a little bit about the South being a little bit more religious and different. States have different
a lot more religion
a lot more religious. Why you deal, you both have some hard facts to show why we are, and then there's some a little bit of sort of speculating is not the right word, but some informed theories about why we are more religious than other parts of the country.
Yeah, well, there is speculation, I'll be honest with you. You know, it's very hard to isolate the reasons why. It's a combination of culture and history. Now, as I say in the book, I thought, well, maybe this has changed. You know, in the old days, states, people didn't move. You were born in a state. You were born in Mississippi. You stayed there the rest of your life, and you didn't move. You were born in North Carolina. But now, of course, there's a lot of mobility, and also there's the media. In the old days, you didn't have all this exposure. Now we're all watching and the same things and getting the Internet and getting all the same news. And yet there's still these persistent, very strong state cultures, which is really fascinating. Even though there's a lot of mobility as well. I mean, you look at North Carolina, it's had a huge influx over the years of people that weren't born in North Carolina, because it's an attractive state for retirement and the economy and all that. And yet, to this day, it's the fifth most religious state in the country. So a lot of things change, but some things don't. The reasons why, it's hard to know. I looked at a lot of reasons, and I said maybe it's ethnicity. Blacks are the most religious group in America, ethnic group, and they're more prevalent in the South. So that's maybe the reason, but that's not. The whites in the South are more religious than whites elsewhere.
So if
it's
you
not
took
the type of religion.
If you took
Catholics
the...
are more religious in the South than in Vermont and so forth. So I ruled out a lot of hypotheses and don't really have a full explanation.
I get, just to emphasize what you're saying, that if you speculated that we're more religious because African-American population, African-Americans tend to be more religious, but you say, if I've got this right, you say that, well, you just take the black population out of North Carolina, and North Carolina remains one of the most religious states, so it can't...
That's right. You're absolutely right. So it's not... I have a good example there. If you look at blacks in Mississippi and then look at blacks in Rhode Island, the blacks in Mississippi are hugely more religious than blacks in Rhode Island. So it's not just the racial composition of the states. And it's not the type of religion that's there. It's not whether they're married or not. It's not a lot of things. There's just something about the culture. Let's just take the two extreme states in Mississippi that is very religious, and something about the culture in Vermont that's very non-religious. It leads me to believe that if you move to Vermont, you're going to be less religious. Normatively, people just don't go to church as much. They don't talk about religion. And if you move to Mississippi, you're going to become more religious because everybody around you is more religious. So there's this persistent state culture, even here in this year 2012, when we have such intermingling of people in media and so forth.
So your idea is that if that black person in Rhode Island, who's not as religious as his cousin maybe in Mississippi, moves to Mississippi, he's going to become more religious and adopt
That's correct.
The culture of that area or that state?
That's my hypothesis. And in fact, that's what's been happening. I looked at the census data on mobility over the last 10 years, and there's been more movement to highly religious states than non-religious states. So California is a good example. It's no longer growing. People are leaving California, and it's one of the least religious states in the country. So that could affect religiousness. If we have more people moving to religious states, like your example, if more people move to Mississippi, then our overall religiousness may be higher in the country. Now, that's a hypothesis, as we say scientifically. I don't have the proof or the data for it. Wow. But to me, that's a reasonable hypothesis.
We're visiting with Dr. Frank Newport about his new book, God is Alive and Well. Dr. Newport, one of the things that interests me, and I guess we'll just can talk about it a little bit more if you will, and that is your idea that not only do the regions of the country have different cultures, but that states themselves, states within regions, have a separate culture, so that North Carolina is different from Virginia, North Carolina is different from South Carolina, Mississippi is different from Alabama in terms of their culture, even within the same region. And are we really 50 different states that have different cultures?
That's what's so amazing about it, particularly because of the mobility. I think North Carolina is a great example, as I mentioned, because North Carolina is now full of a lot of people who moved there. And for good reason. And yet North Carolina retains its position as one of the most religious states. Yeah, look at your neighbor Virginia, which is way down the list. Virginia is not nearly as religious as North Carolina. Florida, for example, is just at the national average. It's not more religious than anybody else. So these are some states you would think are in the South, and yet there's some big differences in how religious they are. So yeah, every state's different and distinct. Utah is a good example. Generally, states out in the West are not that religious, like Nevada and California. But Utah is one of the top 10 religious states in the country, and that's because, of course, it has a heavy Mormon population, and Mormons are the most religious, single religious group in America.
I found one of the most interesting parts of your book is following up on this description of Utah, and if we can talk about Utah for just a minute. You said the Mormons in Utah are religious, just as Mormons have a high degree of in their religion, but what about the other people who are not Mormons in Utah? You say that the states tend to be like in Mississippi, the Catholics are just as religious as the Protestants, but what about in Utah? How does it work?
Well, it's very fascinating when I looked at the data, because Utah is a great state to look at, to examine, because as you pointed out, 57% of Utahns are Mormon. It's not 100% Mormon, by the way. It used to be higher, but Utah's had a lot of growth. So a lot of non-Mormons have moved in. And some people in Utah who were raised Mormon have left the Mormon church. But nevertheless, only 2% of the American population is Mormon. And yet 57% of Utah is Mormon. So clearly it's a highly Mormon state. And as I mentioned, Mormons are the most religious group in America. By that I mean people who are Mormon go to church more often and say church religion is important to them more so than any other religious group. So therefore, those Mormons are highly religious. That's no shock. Mormons are religious wherever they are. You don't find a lot of Mormons outside Utah, but Idaho has some. Arizona contiguous states. There are relatively few Mormons elsewhere. Mitt Romney lives in Massachusetts, but he's, on a relative basis, one of the few Mormons in the state. But wherever you are as a Mormon, you're religious. But that 43% of Utah who are not Mormons, interestingly, are actually below average in religiousness.
Yeah, that was why is that? Why is that?
Well, we don't know. It could be that they're rebelling against the Mormon culture. It could be the kind of people who moved to Utah because of the booming economy. Tend to be non-religious when they move in. We don't know for sure, but Utah is an example where it's not a state culture. It's the one exception that if all the Mormons left Utah, it would be like its neighbor, like Nevada. It would not be a very religious state. But it's propped up by this huge Mormon population. And again, Mormons are highly religious.
I was also talking about different brands of religion. I was interested in the facts that you talked about in terms of the situation of Catholics in the United States. Generally growing, but as you say, yeah, but watch out. They wouldn't be growing unless it was for the Hispanic growth.
That's right. And, Catholics as a percent of the population have remained about the same. Right now, about 23% of Americans, adults, are Catholic. And, you know, if you look back in history, you know, between 20 and 25% of Americans have long been Catholic. But you're right. When you look at religious switching, religious mobility, Catholics have more people leaving the church than coming in significantly among whites. They lose a lot of people raised Catholic. So if we had not had an in-migration of Hispanics, the Catholics would be shrinking as a percent of the population. But they've been saved by this big in-migration of Hispanics, the significant majority of whom are Catholic. And that's why, if you're Catholic and listening to this, you're not surprised, because a lot of the ministers now are Spanish-speaking. Our data show 40% plus of young Catholics are already Hispanic. So the Catholic Church is going to turn more and more to be a Hispanic church in the years ahead. You have a lot of older white Catholics worshiping with younger Hispanic Catholics. Now, part of the problem for Episcopalians or Presbyterians, to pick two examples, is they haven't had an in-migration. There's been no huge wave of Presbyterians, you know, illegally or not, coming into this country. So that's how they haven't been able to gain, because they haven't had an in-migration of people. When this country was founded, there were very few Catholics. It was a Protestant country. You know, we've had several waves of Catholics who came over in the 1800s from Europe, Ireland, Europe, Italy, other countries like that. And now we have more recently this influx of Catholics coming from Mexico, South and Central America. So the Catholic population in the U.S. has been largely a result of in-migration that's resulted since the country was founded.
Well, does that mean that except for the Catholic Church and the migration of people who happen to be Catholics, otherwise the established churches, you mentioned the Presbyterians and the Episcopalians, but also your brand, let's just say the Methodist, and then maybe to some degree the Southern Baptist, are that these establishment brands aren't competitive because they're not growing. They don't have the influx of migrants to boost them up.
Yep. Well, yeah, they're not growing for several reasons, I point out in the book. If you want to grow a group of people, you could do it several ways. One is to have new immigrants move in that are part of your group. As I say, that's what the Catholics did. But these groups you just mentioned, Methodists and Episcopalians and Baptists, don't have large in-migration. They're losing there. The other is internal reproduction or babies. Now, the Mormons are smart. They have theologically encouraged lots of babies, and that's a way to grow. Because over generations, three or four generations, you really, if you have 10 children and those 10 children have 10 children, you can do the math. And if they all keep being Mormons, that's really going to grow. Catholics used to have that advantage because they had large families. But that's died down now, and non-Hispanic Catholics don't have any larger families than anybody else. So they're losing out there. So these Presbyterians and Baptists and Methodists are losing out on all those fronts, and they're not converting lots of people. In the U.S. They're not having waves of conversion that pull people into those denominations. So they're losing out. And what we're seeing the growing is non-denominational churches. A lot of people who used to be Presbyterian or Episcopalian or Baptist now say, well, I'm just a Christian and I go to a Bible church down the road that's not really affiliated with any formal denomination. That's the big growth area.
Well, I was interested in your family experience in terms of the evangelism imperative that used to be a part of many of the mainline churches, but particularly the Baptist, that there was you go calling on people and you would have, this is the home state of Billy Graham, you would have tent meetings and you'd have rallies and revivals to what we call save people. And that was apparently part of your growing up culture as well. But there doesn't seem to be that kind of confidence that we have the answer to people's problems, that we're willing to go knock on their doors or to even have these, the establishment churches at least, of having these tent meetings. Is that?
That's right. Now, I think the Southern Baptist, which is the religion I was raised in, as you mentioned, still talk about evangelism a lot if you read their literature. But it's my impression it's not the same as it used to be. There's been a movement. Southern Baptists are now more are increasingly concerned with social issues. You know, they're taking stances publicly on abortion and same-sex marriage and politics and things like that. In the old days, Southern Baptists were divorced from politics, and they were out trying to convert people, you know, raise people up. So I think that has been a change. Even though they talk about conversion and planting seed churches and stuff like that, I'm not sure that's got as much emphasis as it used to be. And so that's certainly not helping them grow. And I don't think you see a lot of Presbyterian ministers, as an example, or Presbyterians out knocking on doors and trying to convert people. So they're not growing either for that reason. The Mormons, in terms of growth, they're doing both those things right. They're having lots of babies because they theologically have a justification for having lots of children. So Mormons tend to have big families. The data show that. And second, Mormons do evangelize. A lot of it overseas, but you know, you see the guys in the white shirts and the black ties knocking on doors. They try. So the Mormons are trying to grow in those two ways, but you just don't have, like Methodists aren't having more babies, and they're not out actively evangelizing, so they're losing out on both those ways that they could theoretically grow.
We're visiting with Dr. Frank Newport about his new book, God is Alive and Well, The Future of Religion in America. Dr. Newport, Mormons are very active here. You mentioned, I think, did you say that Mormons only make up about 2% of the population in the United States? But they're growing, aren't they? I mean, it's a growing dynamic.
Well, they're growing, but not by enough to really affect these percentage numbers materially. Remember, the adult population in America, let's say, is well over 200 million people. So to grow 1%, you got to add 2 million or more people. So even though the Mormons are growing, they're not growing enough to hugely affect those percentages. So people are surprised at that, but that's the facts. Our data show 2% of Americans are Jewish. People are surprised at that. They often think it's bigger. Less than 2% in our survey say that they're Muslim, and people are surprised at that. So when you look at the data, people actually get surprised at the degree to which we don't have large percentages of people that are members of some of these religions other than the traditional Protestant Christian religions and Catholicism.
Can we talk a little bit about the points that you make in terms of the gender differences in terms of the religious views? We like to say more and more that there are not as many differences as we have made out to be between the sexes. Your surveys show, with respect to religion, that there are differences between men and women.
Yeah, and it's a pretty strong fact of life. It occurs in this country at all ages. That is the gender gap in religiousness. And it occurs in most countries where we do interviews. You go to Italy, go to England, go to Germany, go to Poland, go to South America. In most of these countries, women are going to be more religious than men. So it's kind of almost like a fact of life. In this country, 18-year-old girls are more religious than 18-year-old boys. And then when you get to age 90, 90-year-old women are more religious than 90-year-old men. So it's a fairly universal fact of life that our data show is documented across a lot of different groups within religions, within states, wherever you want to look. Why that's the case, I talk about in the book. Again, we don't know for sure. It's almost like we have this fact of life that we don't know why. There's speculation. Some of it's genetic. You know, people say women have certain roles in the family culture through the, you know, millennia of being. They obviously give birth. Men don't give birth. They're more likely to raise children. That could be connected with becoming more religious. There's some cultural reasons. Women have been more oppressed historically, just like other minorities. And maybe religion was a way to survive being in an oppressed role, which is true in cultures historically. There are other reasons. But for whatever the speculation, women are more religious than men, and there's little way around that.
In terms of getting wrapping around an understanding, it's not so much that is it that women that a woman might be more religious, but that more women are religious, have a high degree of religiousness than men in the same sort of categories. That the numbers show maybe roughly 10-15% below. It's at different ages and different categories, but it's numbers. You all measured the numbers, I guess.
That's right. We're not just speculating. We're looking at the actual numbers. And with these large samples, we can look across age. So we can look at an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, 20-year-old. And if we look at the graph in the book, it's consistent. There's this gap, women on top of men in terms of religiousness, that just extends all the way across the age spectrum. And I look at it within religion, within ethnic groups, in any way you want to look at it, women are more religious than men, for the most part, with a few exceptions. And that's very fascinating, but very fundamental fact of life. Women are shorter than men on average. That's what the data show. You can't get around that on average. They're short men and tall women, but on average, women are shorter. And the data seem to show the same kind of thing, although they're atheist women and highly religious men. On average, women are more religious than men. That's what the data show.
You wrestle with the another question that has to do with gender, and that is that some of the larger religious groups in America are, I don't want to say, burdened is not the right word, but they have adopted, or they could, I guess they maintain the view that the high leadership positions in their churches are reserved for men. And you wonder more than you are able to document with numbers what this means for the future of those organizations. And I wonder if you would speculate with us a little bit about the challenges that are faced by your historic affiliation with the Southern Baptists, with the Catholics, and there are some of the major independent religious groups forbid women from taking leadership position, or the high leadership positions, the teaching elder or preacher's positions, because of the way they read some of St. Paul's letters.
You're absolutely right that I'm speculating, not necessarily knowing this for sure, but it is a conflict because women are most religious, as we've been talking about it, and yet the two single largest groups in America, religious groups, are the Roman Catholic Church and the Southern Baptist denomination. And both officially by doctrine say women can't be ministers. Now, the Southern Baptists obviously aren't as hierarchical as the Roman Catholics. So you have nominally Southern Baptist churches with women ministers because each church ordains its own people. But officially at the seminaries and the Faith and Message Statement, if you look at it, Baptists say, as you say, deriving from New Testament writings, that women are not supposed to be pastors and ministers. And, of course, the Roman Catholic Church is very strict about that, for whatever its historic reasons, that priesthood is reserved for men, no way around that. So it's kind of ironic that you're not allowing your most religious people to be in the positions of high leadership. In other denominations, like the Methodists and the Presbyterians and a lot of these mainline Protestant groups, women are taking over the ministry. Even in the Jewish faith, for the all but Orthodox Jewish faith, there are a lot of female rabbis. So women are moving rapidly into these clergy positions a lot of places. But they cannot do it by doctrine, at least officially in the Catholics and Southern Baptists and some other fundamentalist faiths. So I speculate in the book, what does this mean for the future? This could be a conflict. You know, women may start to, they haven't to date, but we may see women starting to leave these faiths who want to express themselves by being in a position of leadership. So I don't know that's going to happen. We could get into a big theological argument about it, but I'm simply saying in the book that that's at least a possibility going forward. When you have these kind of tensions, sometimes things have to be resolved.
I want you to talk about one of the things that may be one of the most salient parts of your book, and that's what you call your R&R rule. Will you tell us about your R&R rule and what kind of reaction you've gotten from the association between degree of religiosity or religion and the tendency to be affiliated with one political party or another?
Yeah, the R&R rule is fairly straightforward. If you're more religious, you're more Republican. And that's pretty strong across many groups and many segments of the population, with the exception of blacks, who are highly religious and highly democratic. So they fly against the rule. But other than that, it's a strong rule. We saw in this last election, and the exit polls showed that those who said they go to church frequently are much more likely to vote for Romney than those who infrequently go to church are more likely to vote for Obama. So it's a pretty strong relationship there. What this means for the future is interesting. Obviously, the Democrats managed to win the presidency in both their most two recent elections without the vote of highly religious white voters. so it wasn't crippling for them. But in the future, you know, you never know. It could be more important, and therefore I think Democrats may look at it seriously. Some are already doing it, like Obama made a speech where he talked about the religious vote earlier this year, and I think people may start to say, of the Democratic persuasion, maybe we should go after the religious vote and try to convince highly religious people that they should not just be Republicans by rote, but that they should be Democrats for X, Y, and Z reasons.
Well, you know, you've got the numbers to show to back up your rule. But those of us who've watched politics, I mean, starting with Jimmy Carter, who was, he was part of your background, a Southern Baptist and very devout, taught Sunday school there in Plains. Bill Clinton was one of the best preachers I've ever heard. He may not have, lived the perfect life, but he as you have to, I guess, as a Southern governor, he talked a religious game and seemed to be sincere in his religion. And not too sure about Obama, but he seemed to be a devoted churchgoer. At least until his relationship with his pastor exploded. But, I mean, Democrats have been sensitive to this notion that Americans seem to prefer presidents who have strong religious attachments. On the other hand, except for George W. Bush, some of the Republican presidents didn't have all that strong and church-going experienced. Ronald Reagan had the support of evangelicals, but he wasn't all that big a churchgoer. Gerald Ford, Eisenhower, these were not bang-bang religious people. It looks like the Democrats, at least in the presidency, they've had more cheerleaders for religion than the Republicans have.
Well, you know, those are good examples. All presidents have some religious faith, because the data show you can't, even if you are an atheist, you shouldn't say it. So all presidents have a religious faith. And you're right, if you look just at personal religiosity, of course, this year, both, you know, as you say, Obama is very religious. He says he's religious. He talks about it. And, of course, Mitt Romney was very religious. And Bush was religious, had a conversion experience, helped him stop drinking and stuff like that. We don't know. Kerry was a Catholic in 2004. Who is nominally religious, and then Al Gore was raised as a Southern Baptist himself, although I don't think he was, you know, evidenced strong religion when he ran in 2000. But you're right, some of these elected presidents or Democrats seem to be quite religious, but nevertheless, the data show, regardless of the personal religious preferences of presidents or candidates, underneath it all, highly religious people vote for the Republican candidate, non-religious people vote for the Democratic candidate, with the exception of blacks. So that's a fact of life, and it's been there since Reagan, and it was evidenced again in this election. If only highly religious people had voted, Romney would be our president right now.
We're visiting with Dr. Frank Newport. We're talking about his new book, God is Alive and Well, The Future of Religion in America. Dr. Newport, I want to talk a little bit more, if you will, about the politics of religion, and what difference does it make that highly religious people tend towards being Republicans, and as your numbers show, those who tend not to be so religious tend to be Democrats. What difference does that make for our country?
Well, I think it's intercorrelated with policy issues. I think I mentioned earlier that, for example, positions on same-sex marriage are intercorrelated with religion, and that's intercorrelated with being the Republican Party. So the fact that you have more religious voters being Republicans and less religious voters being Democrats has an impact on policy. Maybe it shouldn't be the case long term, or that'll change, but that's where it is right now. And I think Republicans are more likely to accept some inequalities and the fact that there are right and wrong, because they tend to be more religious, whereas Democrats are less likely to say that there can be strict hierarchies and more likely to say there shouldn't be, because they're less likely to say there's an absolute right or wrong. But however you interpret it, and it gets complex theologically, the fact that you have religion being a big dividing point between the two denominations has a real impact on policy positions and a lot of other important things in America.
Well, it's interesting. I wondered, as you describe the conservative or the Republican issues that coincide with some of the very strong issues of some religious people, these your illustrations or examples were the abortion issue, the gay marriage, or the just the general social issues. If it weren't for those very divisive and people just divide up and have strong feelings about these issues still, are these particular issues the reason you think that religious people tend to be Republicans? Is it issues?
Well, they're certainly related. In other words, Republicans have the allegiance of more religious people, and that the issues that are talked about most often are these family values issues like abortion and same-sex marriage. So for some reason, they've been intercorrelated. What I think may change is that the Democrats may start to argue, forget those issues, look at other issues, and that's why you should, as a religious person, be more Democratic. Issues like equality and justice and sympathy for the poor, Democrats may try to shift the focus off of things like same-sex marriage and abortion and put it more on other issues. So that's the coming battleground, I think, that we may see in religion. But to this point in time, some of the reasons that how the religious people are Republican, if you interview them, they say, well, it's because of abortion and same-sex marriage. They talk about these family value issues, and that's where they really see a difference to the Democratic Party. So Democrats have the challenge of trying to come after these religious voters and try to reach them on some other grounds, assuming that the Democrats aren't going to change their position on abortion and same-sex marriage.
We've only got just a little bit of time, but I was intrigued by your really strong identification family-wise with the, you know, you're from a religious family of professionals, and clearly your interest in this topic, you know, it's I would just say it sweetens the deal. And how? But you must, as a scientist, you must have had to say, how do I stay a scientist when I've got all of these this background as a, you know, raised in the Southern Baptist Church? How do you deal with that? And can you share with us some of your own personal observations from what you've learned from your study?
Well, then, you know, that's a very good question. I don't think that being religious is antithetical to being scientific. My father was a theologian and a seminary professor, but he had a lot of respect for knowledge and science and scholarship, so he wasn't anti-science at all himself. He thought the two were compatible. And as I grew up and saw a lot of religion around me, I came to the conclusion, on the one hand, that religion was very, very important, a very powerful force in America. But on the other hand, I got a personal interest in science and saying, well, if we're going to look at social life, let's look at it using the tools of science rather than just being a philosopher and just kind of philosophizing about it. So I've managed to put those two together. I taught sociology of religion and have published books, including this one on religion, using the surveys as part of that. And I don't think that my book shows, although I wrote the book as an objective social scientist, the book actually shows there's a powerful case for the power of religion. So it's a good example of where science doesn't toss religion out, as some scientists would argue it should, but actually a scientific look at our data shows that, you know, huge Americans are religious, a huge number of them, and it makes a difference. So in my own personal life, I certainly grew up with an appreciation for an immersion in a religious culture, and I still continue to be fascinated by religious to this day, but I'm coming at it in this particular perspective.
Well, it came across that you were sort of glad to have this conclusion, that in terms of well-being, just generally speaking, the numbers show that people, that a high degree of religious feelings and attachment coincides with a high degree of a feeling of well-being and good health and, you know, a good life.
Well, that's one of the things the data shows. There's no question about that, that there is a correlation between being religious and also having higher well-being and satisfaction and happiness and to some degree health. Causation's a different question. We don't know for sure what causes what, but we think being religious actually may cause the other. And so that's an interesting finding. You know, in science, we have found out, for example, that exercise is correlated with much better outcomes in terms of your health. We know that not eating fatty foods is correlated with better outcomes, and we clearly know that not smoking is correlated with higher better outcomes, and now we know that religion, being religious, is correlated with better outcomes. So as long as we're willing to assume there's some causality there, that's an important fact to know. In fact, I was doing an interview, and the person told me that somebody came to him with an insurance policy and said, if you can prove you go to church a couple of weeks a month, you'll get a discount on the premiums because people are healthier that go to church. So maybe we have more of that in the future.
Well,
that you get a discount on your health insurance if you prove you're religious. So the relationship is there. It could have interesting implications for our future.
Well, Dr. Frank Newport, thanks for this very stimulating and interesting book and for taking time to share all of this with your new friends in Chapel Hill, and we're very grateful to you.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Our guest has been Dr. Frank Newport. His book, God is Alive and Well, The Future of Religion in America. This has been D.G. Martin and Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.